picking up a little bit of an echo, and I don't really. It turns everything off. Picking up an echo, and I don't really know why. Hopefully, the sound is okay for you. But we'll just kind of do the best we can with what we've got.
It's good on my end. It's possible somebody's not muted. I'm crying here today.
That's right. My nebulous voice in the ether world or whatever. Okay, so I am going to hit record, even though I do hear, still hear the echo, but that's okay. We'll deal with it. Started. Okay. Apparently it's recording. I just can't see it on this little bitty screen. I'm used to having my big computer screen that I can see it better with or on or whatever. The one. Of you Miss Hill is going to be coming over toward the end of class probably or sometime, and we will pass out your PPE and mark you off the list. We're just trying to get it in everybody's hands before you start clinical next Tuesday, because it's a Halloween and he's kind of messes me up pretty good. Because we just were off Monday and Tuesday with the snow. Anyway, so I'm Susan Snell. It's kind of a pleasure to see everybody here today. It's kind of difficult when you're just infectious disorder. Now, so that you're just not staring at me, I've converted the information. The same thing you have on your hand. And it's just in a hand, in a PowerPoint form, just to kind of guide us as we go and get us into, if you choose to enable. Okay, so we're going to start off briefly, or as we talk about them. On the handout, I've listed are different in their anatomy and physiology, and what's going on differently as far as immature immune system, things like that that can affect how they respond. So the common medical treatments that we use for immunologic disorders, of course, are immunizations. And we need to think about the nursing implications and think about, overlying this thought is immunocompromised. So we're immunocompromised, and that's our overlying little umbrella, and we're going to give immunizations, but we have to think about the nursing implications for those immunizations. So the big deal is we don't give live virus vaccines, and we said this yesterday as well, we don't give live virus vaccines to those that are immunocompromised. And we need to remember that the methods of administration and contraindications will vary by vaccine. So there might be some things that we have to do a little bit differently with the immunocompromised, et cetera. We can also do bone marrow or stem cell transplantation. in. And I mean, that is really, really, really on the forefront in research and everything as far as doing the bone marrow or doing stem cell transplantation for some of these immune conditions. We also give them medications, and there's a table in your book, 47.1, page 1849 and 50. And in that table, when it's talking about medications, a lot of them you've done before. You've had these medications in second level when you did your farm. So you talked about NSAIDs, yeah? You've talked about corticosteroids, and we know we have to be careful with corticosteroids. We know that we taper off. We don't, you know, just come off abruptly. We know all the implications for corticosteroids, and if you've kind of forgotten those, you need to refresh and remember, perhaps. We can also use IVIG, intravenous immune globulin. And we do IVIG. It is administered. It's a lot like like an IV, little vial, diluted, administered. So you can look over indications for using that as well. The other thing, and your book's really good about hitting the nursing process as it goes through, but we have to think about the nursing process. And we talked about this a lot yesterday. So we remember assessment, nursing diagnoses, goals, interventions, evaluation. We remember all of those things, and we have to think about them because that same process does not change. Even though we're talking immunocompromised, it does not change. So, nice to know if this would work. It just does. So, there's also primary immunodeficiencies, and I mentioned them here. I do not go in depth in any of these because I feel with pediatrics it's very, very important that we cover the things that are common or more common, things we're more likely to see. These conditions are a lot rarer in that we don't see these a lot. Some of these I've never seen. I've never seen Wiskott-Aldridge syndrome. And it's, again, Wiskott-Aldridge is a rare X-linked. Remember what I mean by X-linked. Who's affected? If it's X-linked or sex-linked, who's affected? Males, right? Who's the carrier? Females, right? Okay. So it's a genetic disorder, and these are the things it results in, and it causes thrombocytopenia, and you know what thrombocytopenia is, deficiency of platelets in the blood, right? And if we have a deficiency of platelets, we can bleed or bruise, we can bleed into tissues, we can bruise, we can have slow clotting after injury, all of those things. So we just kind of think about that a little bit as well. And that's all written on your handout. Hypogammaglobulinemia is when the child doesn't form antibodies appropriately. And this is a child that would receive IVIG. So I've mentioned IVIG twice. So I think I would kind of just look over that little table and look at IVIG and see if there's anything we need to know. And there's also another one that's rare, and that's severe combined immune deficiency, and it's also X-linked or autosomal recessive, and it's characterized by absent T-cell and B-cell function. I mentioned those just for the basis that you can hear the words. They are listed as primary immunodeficiencies. We don't tend to cover so much the primary immunodeficiencies. We instead cover secondary immunodeficiencies, and the great big one is HIV. I've got the pathophysiology on your handout. You can read over that to refresh your memory as far as what HIV affects and what it causes. The bottom line with HIV is they can't fight infections that it normally could. Bottom line, they can't fight infections that they normally could. There's no cure for HIV infection, but survival has improved. And that's due to HART, H-A-A-R-T, or highly active antiretroviral therapy. And that too is on your handout. And it's done a lot of things as far as improving growth, improving neurodevelopment, and improving immune function. So it's important to understand with our secondary and with HIV in particular, how is it transmitted? So how would the fetus or infant get HIV? Cross the blood barrier. Which blood barrier are we talking about? Okay. Placenta. Very good. Yes. Fetus and infant can get that across the placenta. An infant can also get HIV at delivery. An infant can also get HIV through breastfeeding. And again, in the United States, perinatal transmission has improved or has decreased dramatically because of improved maternal detection. So we're finding it in our moms, we're treating it in our moms, we're finding it early in our infants, and we're treating it early in our infants. So that's very, very good. I really wish y'all could see. It doesn't say anything really, it's just words. I can throw it down. Again, you can see the words. I can't see Netfish, but that's okay. I was wondering if this turned that one on. I'm sorry, it's over there. I'm not going to mess with technology anymore. So anyway, how would a child get HIV? Sexual abuse. The great unspoken. But typically, if you have a child with HIV, new case, not came with it at birth, new case HIV, then we're going to think sexual abuse. Same thing if you have a child with any of the STIs. It's not a normal thing for a child to have, and so you're going to think sexual abuse. HIV is no different. What about an adolescent? Very big one, sexual activity, right? How about IV drug use? Yeah, it's still happening. It's still out there. Another thing I didn't really think about a lot, what about tattoos? Because the whole process of tattooing, I mean, if you have unsterile needles or I call them garage tattoos, my daughter in her younger, wilder days came back home. And it's like she was sporting a tattoo, and course thought I was blind and I wasn't going to see it. And it's like, well, my friend's uncle had some tattoo equipment in his garage. You did what? But anyway, so yeah, tattoos is another thing that we sometimes don't think about. Blood transfusions these days is very, very rare because everybody screened and we're much more aware of that. Previously, before we had such really good blood screening processes, you could have children, adolescents, etc., with HIV that they received through a blood transfusion. Not a good place to be, but again. Okay, so we think about our nursing assessment, and these are normal things. These are in our health history. We're going to ask them, and we're going to, when we interview them, we're going to find out what signs and symptoms do they have? What are they reporting? And these are the things that they might tell you. Failure to thrive, which is FTD. Failure to thrive, recurrent bacterial infections. Remember what we said at the beginning about they're not able to fight off normal infections that others can. Recurrent bacterial infections is a big one. Opportunistic infections, and I know you talked about these when you talked about HIV, however briefly, in second level. Chronic or recurrent diarrhea. Recurrent or persistent fever, developmental delay, and prolonged candidiasis. Candida causes a yeast infection. We can have candida, oral candida, which is thrush a lot of times. So you might have a candidal infection. They might have thrush, but they just have difficulty getting rid of it. So it's prolonged. Our physical exam, inspection and observation. Usual things we're going to inspect, we're going to observe. We're going to check for fever. We're going to measure their height and weight on the growth chart. We want to make sure that's within normal limits. Okay, we're going to do developmental screenings. We talked about those some yesterday. We're looking for delays. Are they not achieving milestones that they should be achieving? Are they not able to do things when they should be doing them? We're going to look in their mouth, inspect the oral cavity. And again, we're looking for candida or thrush. See if we have those white curd-like plaques in their mouth. We're going to assess them for the work of breathing. Sometimes they're irregular breathing. We're going to assess for their work of breathing. If they're healthy breathing, if their breathing is more lower indication, especially that's increased if they have pneumonia or a pneumonitis, because we're affecting the lungs, so that's going to make breathing more difficult for them. Their level of consciousness. If they develop HIV encephalopathy, brain's affected, then that will affect or depress their level of consciousness. Okay. We're going to auscultate and palpate. Listen to the lungs. Listen for abnormal breath sounds. Going to palpate those lymph nodes. Are any lymph nodes enlarged? We're going to palpate their abdomen. When we palpate their abdomen, we're looking for enlarged spleen or enlarged liver. So they would have hepatomegaly or hepatosplenomegaly. So their liver and their spleen can also enlarge. So we're going to palpate bellies and see if we feel a large liver or spleen. We're also going to do labs and diagnostics. We can do It's called the reverse transcriptase polymerase chain reaction. Write down PCR. We can do the PCR test, and that's going to detect presence of infection in infants older than 1 month. And it used to exclude infection as early as possible. So they have to be older than 1 month, but they can do the PCR, and that can exclude it, perhaps, or help us detect it earlier. They can also do the ELISA, E-L-I-S-A, or the enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay. The ELISA test will be positive in infants of HIV-infected mothers because they have those antibodies that they acquired via the placenta from their moms. So they have transplacental antibodies that they get from their mom. So if their mom has HIV, they have the antibodies that they got from mom. And so this ELISA test will come out positive if mom is positive or has HIV. This is less accurate in detecting HIV in infants and toddlers. We would go back to the PCR test because this is just telling us they have antibodies, and it's if mom had it, then the baby's going to have it. So we don't know if the baby actually has it because they have these antibodies. Does that make sense? And we remember the CD4 counts will be low if they have or are in the presence of HIV infection. So CD4 counts are low. Yes.
The medication management, it has a link from the
baseline. I haven't gotten to medication management, have I? I've got nursing management next, don't I? Oh. Well, on my copy of the form, it's the other way around. So hang on to that. We're getting to it. I'm sorry. I don't know why that is kind of backwards from what I've got. You have nursing management next.
For nothing.
Okay.
It was under therapeutic management before nursing assessment.
I see it. I'm sorry. Medications prescribed based on severity of child symptoms. I'm sorry. I jumped over that one. Thank you for pointing that out. So medications are prescribed on the basis of the child's severity of symptoms. Then we have nursing assessment. Okay. So we're back on track. Everybody else good? Tamika, are you muted?
Yes, I was.
Nursing management is next. Number one thing for nursing management. Well, I've got all these things listed. On your handout, of course, we're going to avoid infection because that's very important. So if they have this, we want to make sure we don't expose them to infection. We know the basics of doing that. Yes. I don't know why this is different, but that's okay. Medication compliance, and that's is on there. Prevent and protect infection. medication compliance, realize when they have or they're diagnosed with HIV, medication is lifelong. It's not a start and stop. It's not a I get better and I can stop my medication. We really need to think about the adverse effects of some of these medications. It's very important that they take medications on a very regular schedule, that they don't skip doses. Because if they skip doses, then we're going to have a problem perhaps with drug effectiveness. Because some of these medications have to have a steady stream, build up, whatever. So if they start skipping around with doses, it can affect the drug effectiveness. We want to promote nutrition. The infant will need an increased calorie formula. So we're going to increase our calories. Remember, one of the things that they might report is failure to thrive. Failure to thrive means we're feeding them, but they're not growing as they should. Their weight is lagging back. There's some reason or issue that's going on with their feeding, perhaps. Or they're absorbing. They're not absorbing nutrition, etc. So infant will increase the calories. The child, we want to make sure we put them on a high-calorie, high-protein diet. And you can even add protein supplements to their diet if need be. And it's also very important that we document their growth. Remember, we talked about whenever they go for a visit, we plot their weight and their height. We do a growth chart. We see where they're at, what percentile they're at, and whether that's all proceeding normally. So we want to follow their growth as well. Okay? Pain management and promote comfort. We think about that because these kiddos usually go through a lot of different procedures. And the procedures can be very painful. Or they have treatment. And they can be painful. So we need to make sure that we're keeping in mind that fifth vital sign, which is pain. So we need to think about that. We need to educate. And who are we educating? We're educating the family, and we're educating the patient or the client. And the big thing we're educating them on is medications. And we need to provide support. Sometimes we don't think about providing support, but we need to provide support. There's a lot of stress associated with this diagnosis, or when your child is diagnosed with this. If it's a younger child, then you have to think that they most likely received it, like an infant or whatever, could have received it from mom. So you have to think about just the stress of this diagnosis. If you were told you had something and there's no cure for the disease that you have, stress you would be under. So there's a lot of stress associated with this. It could be the diagnosis, just to hear those words. It could be the financial stress. It puts stress on the family unit, on the family as a whole. There are a lot of appointments. There's hospitalizations. All those things can, again, put stress on the family unit, the patient, everybody. And then think about the stigma. Even though we're here in 2021, there is still stigma associated with HIV. And that is sometimes very difficult to deal with. Prevention. All pregnant women receive routine HIV counseling and testing. If they're HIV positive, we're going to treat them with an antiretroviral. When we talk about HIV exposed infants, they should receive oral ZDV, which is zidovudine, so this ZDV is fine, and they receive that within 6 to 12 hours after delivery, and then they can continue on this medication for 6 weeks. On your handout, I have a question mark by breastfeeding because we started out by saying breastfeeding is a means or a mode of transmission. The school of thought is changing a little bit if you look at research and everything, and I think maybe more importantly, in underdeveloped countries, they're not discouraging breastfeeding because that is the only nutrition the infant will receive. They can't go, if they're in wherever, they can't go down the street to the store to get formula or whatever. So there's different thought about that. Adolescents, big thing with our adolescents is educate them. Teach. We need to teach them about transmission. We need to teach them to wear condoms. We need to teach them about all different forms of sexual activity. Because you'll come up with some differing answers. If you ever get into a discussion with adolescents about sex, you will come up with different answers. And what they perceive. Oral sex is not sex, some of them think. So again, it gets kind of finite, but they need to know. They should limit the number of partners. And to us, that's kind of common sense. Well, yeah, but again, we're dealing with adolescents. They need to know substance abuse or use can impair their judgment. So they might do things they wouldn't normally do when they're under the influence. We need to talk to them about shared IV needles. And we also need to talk to them about tattooing. I'm not a big fan of tattoos. That's just me. I'm old, and I'm not a big fan of tattoos. Do both of my daughters have tattoos? Yeah. But they're grown, and that's their choice. But I've just never been a big fan of that. But if they are going to get a tattoo, then make sure they're getting it at a reputable place, not in somebody's garage or not down the street or whatever. My daughter had a tattoo on her right here in the web of her fingers or whatever. It was just a little hard, but I saw it. My first thought was, it looks like a prison tattoo, which she didn't appreciate hearing. But, and then when she got older and she was working as a server, then of course you can't have visible tattoos, or you couldn't at the time. So then that was a whole other thing. But anyway, my rant, I'm sorry. So, but we need to teach them about tattoos. There's a reason that they're supposed to have parental consent if they get a tattoo and they're a certain age or less. So, I mean, I've seen them in all ages. So, funny thing is they'll come in and we have to do routine immunizations on these 16-year-olds, and they're so afraid of needles, and yet they'll have great big tattoos up here on their arm. We had a young lady, I'm serious, she had a rose tattoo. It was beautiful, beautiful rose tattoo on her arm, her upper arm. And she's like, I'm so, it's like, you're telling me you sat and had this big old tattoo done, and yet you're afraid of a little poke for an immunization. Anyway, so I'm sorry, I digress. I do that a lot. Okay, autoimmune disorders. And there are others besides HIV. As you probably recall, there are others. So, first one we're going to talk a little bit about is systemic lupus. Systemic lupus erythematosus, SLE. It's chronic, it's multi-system, it's autoimmune, characterized by inflammation of the connective tissue. This can affect any system. It's characterized by exacerbations and remissions. This is all written out on your handout. Therapeutic management focuses on treating the inflammatory response. So with mild to moderate lupus, we're going to use non-steroidals. We can use corticosteroids to control the inflammatory response. We can even use anti-malarial agents. It's kind of interesting that you can do that. Severe lupus or frequent exacerbations. This is a little bit opposite order to what's on your handout. So I'm trying to go by the handout to make sure I'm getting everything covered. But severe lupus are those if they're having a lot of flares. So they're okay, and then a week later or 2 weeks later they have an exacerbation and they have the symptoms again. We're going to treat them with high dose corticosteroids, or we can even use some immunosuppressive drugs. So that's not good. And you need to think about, what are the side effects? If I'm giving a patient high dose corticosteroids, do you remember the side effects of steroids? What steroids can cause? Swelling, okay. Kind of like that weight gain. We talk about the Cushing void symptoms or whatever. The buffalo hump, all those crazy things. Weight is a great big thing, especially in adolescent females, because if you put them on high dose steroids and they gain weight, that's not good for them. They don't appreciate that, but we want them to feel better. It can cause GI issues. It can mask signs and symptoms of infection. So again, there are a lot of different side effects from using high dose steroids. If lupus has affected their kidneys and they're in ESR or end-stage renal disease, or glomerulonephritis, then they would have to be put on dialysis. So those are big things. Promote, support, teach, whatever, provide support, teach about medications, chronic illness, diet, exercise, screen use, community resources, all those things that are available to them, we need to teach them about. I didn't cover, and I probably should have because I didn't have it on your handout at all, common manifestations of lupus, and you probably remember these, arthralgias. Alopecia can cause hair loss, anemia, arthritis, fatigue, photosensitivity. Remember, that's why we said something about sunscreen when we're teaching. Photosensitivity, skin rashes. They can have a discoid rash. More typical is that Mallard butterfly rash. So they get that rash, cheeks and over their nose, so it kind of looks like a butterfly. Oral ulcers, seizures, renal disorder. So it can cause a lot of issues just depending upon which system is affected, because it can affect any system. So it's not a good thing. Juvenile, yes, ma'am. Provide support or teach medications. The fact that it's a chronic illness. Diet. Exercise. Sunscreen. And community resources. What's available to them. Got it? Next is juvenile idiopathic arthritis. Juvenile idiopathic arthritis. Idiopathic means we don't know what causes it. It's idiopathic. It's an autoimmune inflammatory disorder that mainly affects the joints. It is characterized by joint swelling, pain, redness, warmth, stiffness. Again, think about arthritis, and you talked about arthritis with your older adults. Okay, this is just happening in juveniles. And we don't really know why they're having it. Or why they develop. Measures as much as any arthritis, really. Non-steroidals, corticosteroids, even anti-rheumatic drugs, such as methotrexate and etanercept. And these help prevent disease progression, etanercept does. And our nursing management is supportive. We direct our nursing management or our care toward pain management and maintaining mobility. We don't want them to lose mobility because of all these problems with their joints. So we want to help them maintain mobility. We can use our medications that will help, especially with our pain management. Range of motion. Muscle strength exercise. We're having problems with the joints, but we want to do some muscle strength exercise. What's the best exercise for doing this, muscle strength? Swimming. Because you're not putting stress on the joints when you swim, and it strengthens your muscles. Teach family or teach the family how to use splints. And we use splints to prevent contractures. Again, depending upon the severity. If we're using splints, we need to remember to look for pressure areas or breakdown, any skin breakdown with use. So anytime we're using a device like that, we need to assess the skin and make sure we're not having areas of skin breakdown or issues with that. And with all things said, we want to help promote a normal life. And that, again, is sometimes difficult. Sure. We want to promote a normal life. These kiddos that have juvenile idiopathic arthritis. Okay. We're also going to talk briefly because it's also in this section, and it's something we need to know about with dealing with kids, is allergy and anaphylaxis. You've probably talked about, if you haven't talked about, you've heard about all the problems with food allergies, and that is an immunologic reaction resulting from the ingestion of a food or a food additive. I know red dye used to be a problem or cause a problem or could cause a problem. During the first few years of life, the most common food allergens are milk, eggs, peanuts, tree nuts. Peanuts and tree nuts are different if you didn't know. Fish, shellfish. And fish and shellfish, peanuts, tree nuts, fish, and shellfish usually persist into adulthood. So you usually don't lose those. Wheat and soy. So I had a friend and she was allergic to tree nuts, but she could eat peanuts. And I was like, I never really thought peanuts grow in the ground and almonds and all those other nuts grow in the trees. Even cashews. Cashews look really weird in the tree. But anyway, we need to determine between allergy, are they truly allergic, or are they intolerant of? You can have a milk intolerance and not be allergic to milk. And you're usually intolerant to the lactose in the milk. But you can have, there's a difference between allergy and there's a difference between intolerance. And the reactions can vary. And they can vary significantly. Management, we want to verify the allergy. They need to avoid the allergen. Well, it's kind of common sense. And we need to treat it with medications. So what medications? It says which ones. Which medications will we use? Antihistamines. We're going to give them epinephrine if they have anaphylaxis. Kids that are typically latex allergic also have food sensitivities. Just an oh, by the way. So if they're latex allergic, then they typically have food sensitivities as well. And after saying that, anaphylaxis, of course, is that severe immediate hypersensitivity reaction. The leading cause of anaphylaxis are peanuts and nuts, eggs, fish, shellfish, bee or wasp stings, some drugs, penicillin and NSAIDs, radiopaque dyes, and latex. Those can all cause anaphylaxis or an anaphylactic reaction. The management of somebody with anaphylaxis, of course, we want to support their airway, breathing, circulation, give them oxygen, administer epinephrine, administer IV fluids to provide volume expansion. So speaking about epinephrine, these children with these allergies should always carry an EpiPen or an EpiPen Junior. They should carry it with them at all times. Everywhere they go, they should have an EpiPen. Everywhere. They came out with a law that said they can carry an EpiPen with them at all times. Because schools had a great big issue about medications. They were going to keep the medication or the EpiPen locked up in the office. If you're having an anaphylactic reaction to a bee sting that you got on the playground, you don't want to have to try to go and find somebody to take care of that reaction. So, but they came out with that law. These kids should have an action plan in place at school. What do we do if this happens? They should also wear medic alert bracelets or some medic alert something that's going to indicate they have an allergy. So if somebody comes across them and they're passed out in the grass or whatever, they have an idea of why they're passed out in the grass. So again, we don't think about that sometimes. Schools got to a point where students couldn't carry peanut butter with them. Some schools, you know, restricted that because sometimes just the smell, how crazy is that? Just the smell would be enough to incite a reaction in some kiddos because they're very sensitive to that. So, you know, they came out and said, you can't bring peanut butter and that kind of thing. So, again, it's just kind of interesting when you think about some of the differences there. Okay, now we're changing gears. We're leaving our immune and we're going to infectious communicable. Infectious communicable disorders, page 1334 to 1376. Your handout says review basic information, 1334 1338, talking about transmission and fever and just those little basic things. There also is your variation in pediatric anatomy and physiology. Again, they are more susceptible to infection because they don't have their immune system built up to some place at that point in time. And young children, because they haven't received the full protection from their immunizations. They're involved in getting their immunizations on board, so they still haven't received protection. Their immunizations are not yet complete. So first we talk about bacterial infections. That's on page 1349 for my book, People. Bacterial infections, we'll start out talking about MRSA. You've talked about MRSA before, most likely. I would imagine you have. Transmission with methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, direct contact, respiratory droplets, blood, or sharing personal items such as sports towels or sports equipment, etc., or contact with contaminated surfaces or items. So we think about that as far as transmission. Can MRSA, community acquired methicillin resistant Staph aureus, skin and soft tissue infections, this is much more common. The CAM MRSA or the community acquired is much more common in the child. And what they will have a bump or raised, red, swollen, painful area. They'll have fever. They'll have fluctuance at the lesion, meaning there's fluid underneath it, so it kind of fluctuates if you push down on it. Think of a blister. And you push down on it and that blister fluctuates some. It'll have purulent drainage. So those are the things that we tend to see as far as the manifestations of CAM MRSA. They make the diagnosis of this through culture. So they will culture that drainage and they will give us a better idea about what's going on. Nursing management, again, we do antibiotics, provide wound care, reassess. Teaching is essential. So what would you teach about the things we just talked about? What would you teach? How to take the antibiotics. what's most important about antibiotics? Take them till they're gone. Don't have any. Yes, ma'am? Okay. Take them till they're gone. Till there's no more left. You shouldn't have any left over, etc. But take them till they're gone. What else? Hand hygiene. How about discourage sharing personal items? And let's talk about some of the risk factors for transmission. As far as cuts and scrapes and things like that need to be kept clean and they need to be kept covered. I mean, we saw some outbreaks or some instances of CAMRSA with our like high school wrestlers because, again, they're in close contact, skin-to-skin contact. Now, of course, with COVID, I don't get to the rest because they can't wrestle when you're 6 feet apart. But that was one of the ways that we could have transmission or that we saw transmission was with
them. Hey, believe it or not, they are wrestling. It blows my mind. We have a grandson that's a senior that will be going to state, and they're still out there face-to-face wrestling with no masks.
Okay. Well, can I turn it down? Well, I don't know. Okay. I guess I did that. I'm sorry. I was talking too loud and they were hearing me in fourth level next door. Okay. Next, and we're still talking about bacterial infections, we have scarlet fever. This is on page 1350. Scarlet fever is an infection from group A strep, usually from strep throat. The symptoms of scarlet fever begin abruptly, with the most striking symptom being erythematous rash on their face, trunk, and extremities that looks like sunburn. So it's red, but if you rubbed your hand along it, it feels like sunburn. And that's for scarlet fever. Some of these textured walls have that same feeling. So I know in the clinic it's more definite, but the textured wall, and so one of the physicians would rub her hand on the wall and she said, oh, that feels like scarlet fever. Because that's pretty classic or significant for scarlet fever infection. It's usually seen in kids 5 to 12 years old. Transmission droplets facilitated by close contact. We see that in schools and in daycares. It can also be foodborne. So how could it be foodborne? We're thinking about human contamination of food. So somebody has it, they're preparing food, and that contaminates the food that they're preparing. So, they're no longer contagious after they've been on antibiotics for 24 hours.
Did you say that it's mostly on the trunk, the chest area?
I said, it's on the face, trunk, extremities. So kind of like body. This is something that they treat at home typically. They're not hospitalized with scarlet fever. We typically use penicillin. That's our drug of choice as far as for treating. If they're allergic to penicillin, we would give them erythromycin. We want to encourage fluids. And their diet would be considered soft foods, warm or cool liquids can be very soothing. Realize this is usually an infection from a strep throat. So we're going to still have to think about those issues. The next is pertussis. Pertussis is also a bacterial communicable infection, as it were. Pertussis is on page 1352. Pertussis is an acute respiratory disorder characterized by paroxysmal cough and copious secretions. Pertussis is characterized by stages. So if you think about pertussis, stage one begins with 7 to 10 days, signs and symptoms of an upper respiratory infection. Okay, so we're at 10 days. Stage two, they have this paroxysmal cough, and it lasts 1 to 4 weeks. So already we're up to about 5 weeks, potentially. The paroxysmal cough increases in severity. The severity of the cough increases. They can have cyanosis with cough, salivation, neck vein distension. Pertussis or whooping cough has a very characteristic sound to the cough. And when you hear pertussis or the cough, the paroxysmal cough from pertussis, it's like cough, 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 okay? Because they're trying to get things out and get things in, and they have that whooping cough, and that's how a lot of people still refer to it. Stage three, the convalescent stage, can last from several weeks to months. The coughing episodes, the whooping, the vomiting, all that will decrease in severity and frequency. But when they're in convalescent stage, they will still have a cough. It doesn't go away magically, but the severity of that cough will decrease. Transmission of this is through direct contact or droplets from coughing. So they cough out droplets, somebody gets it. Most common complication of pertussis is pneumonia. Vaccination. So what do we do? We mentioned this briefly yesterday. The DTaP, diphtheria, tetanus, and acellular pertussis. When do they get the DTaP? So we give it at 2, 4, 6, and 15 months, and then again at their kindergarten physical. So we're building up their immunity to pertussis as well as the others. So we give them DTaP 2, 4, 6, 15, and again at their kindergarten physical. We are seeing an increased incidences of cases in adolescents and adults. So instead of just getting their tetanus booster, their TD booster, they're recommending they get the Tdap. And we talked about the difference of that yesterday. A friend of mine became, what was she? Grandmother? No, not grandmother. Like a great aunt or something. But her niece was making sure all of the family, the grandparents and everybody, had gotten their Tdap booster, because those babies have no immunity to it. And if you have it, it's not going to make adults as sick. But if you have it and you give it to that baby, it's not a good thing. So that's the recommendation now. If you get it, we use a macrolide antibiotic. Does anybody remember what your macrolide antibiotics are? How about they end in mycin? Erythromycin, clarithromycin, azithromycin, any of your mycins. Those are your macrolides, and that's how they treat it. And they also recommend antibiotics for close contacts. So if you have a child with it, they'll go ahead and put parents on it as well, or close contacts. So the nursing management for pertussis, again, physical assessment. And if you're doing a physical assessment on a child with pertussis or suspected pertussis, you're going to check their respiratory status. You're going to check their neuro status. You're going to check their fluid status, their hydration. Because if they're coughing that much and coughing to the point of vomiting sometimes, we have to think about their fluid status. We're going to think about their nutrition status. We're going to think about their INO. We want to provide a high humidity environment and frequent suctioning. Because of all the secretions they have. And they have a lot of secretions. We want to observe for signs of airway obstruction. And you know what those would be. Okay? We're going to encourage fluids, again, because of the secretions that they have. We know encouraging fluids. Fluids help liquefy secretions, so they're better able to get rid of them. We're going to promote rest. We do that, one way we can do that, especially if they're hospitalized with this, is to cluster the care. And by that I mean, don't keep repeatedly going in and doing one something and then 5 minutes later coming in and doing another something. If you can do it all at the same time. Now, don't do it all at the same time if it's going to take you 2 hours to do it all. But try to chunk it up and make it smaller groups, but kind of help promote their rest as best you can by doing that. And again, provide emotional support and reassurance. This is something that's not one and done. We saw that convalescence can last several months, even though they're better. But just think about that 4-week period when they're very sick. And that's difficult. Yes, ma'am. Repeat the macrolide antibiotics. Macrolide antibiotics are the mycins. Erythromycin, clarithromycin, azithromycin. Those are macrolides. Okay. I do not know if these will play. Nope, they will not. See These were just two little clips that I found online, and this is the baby on the left. So if you go home and Google pertussis and you want to see a clip or hear a clip, it's the baby on the left has it, the child on the right has it, the little girl has it. She is perhaps most severe. What she's holding in her hand is a towel because she's coughing to the point that she's throwing up. And Dad said, here, you know, just so she can get rid of those secretions. So, I mean, it's very, very significant when you hear it. And it kind of sticks it in your head a little bit. So if you get an opportunity to do that, I don't know why it's not playing today. It has played in the past, but again, it's a new year. After our last year, who knows? Next, we're going to talk a little bit about viral xanthans. And a xanthan is basically a rash. And you know that. Or you should know that. So a xanthan is basically a rash. So with a viral xanthan, these are their commonalities. Many in viral xanthans, 1356, if you're a book person, 1456, many will have a rash, which we call the xanthan. Most are accompanied by fever. Most have cold or flu-like symptoms, those upper respiratory infection symptoms. Most are transmitted by direct contact with droplets or airborne particles. Most can be prevented by immunization. All require the child be isolated from others to prevent spread. Treatment is mostly symptomatic. It's a virus. It's a viral xanthan, a viral illness. There's not a medication that we can give them because it's not bacterial, it's viral. So we treat the symptoms. Encephalitis is a rare complication, but it can occur as a result of a childhood viral infection. So, viral xanthans. General nursing management, overall, general prevention is huge. And how do we prevent?
Ms. Snell.
Yes.
I have a question in Natchitoches. I just want to know, what immunization would it be that helps the viral? What immunization would help the viral? What did you say? The viral?
They think of the rashes.
The rash.
And I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
It can be prevented by immunization. So what immunization?
It says it can be prevented by immunization. Which immunizations would help prevent it?
Oh, we're going to talk about the immunizations when we talk about the specific condition or the specific viral infection.
Hey, y'all. This is Ms. Wood. It depends on what the viral illness is that's causing the viral xanthan, because most of them cause rashes. So it just depends. It's tied to what the cause is what the vaccine would be. Make sense?
Yeah.
And these are just general, in general, overall with our viral infections, these are the general parameters, and we'll talk about specifics when we talk about the specific conditions. So we do prevent it by immunizing. We do limit exposure. We teach, and again, we're teaching about hand washing. We never forget. Anytime that there can be an answer about that, you can say hand washing most likely, and you'll get it right. Hand washing, and we also teach them about the period of contagion. How long are they contagious? We talk about skincare. With any viral xanthan, skin care is important, and we would teach them about using or doing lukewarm baths with oatmeal or baking soda, because that's very soothing. If you have a rash, xanthan, you have a rash, I pretty much think all these rashes itch, so we need to soothe that skin. We can do it with oatmeal baths. You can go to the store and buy the oatmeal bath stuff that they have in the store. You can take a tube sock and put oatmeal out of your cabinet, just oatmeal in that, tie that sock off, throw that sock in your bath water, in your warm, lukewarm water, and that oatmeal will not really cook, but kind of, you'll put oatmeal in that water. And so, again, that's very, very soothing to the skin. Even baking soda, it's very, very soothing to the skin if you do it in a bath. Keep their fingernails short. We're talking about kids. We're talking about kids with an itchy rash. Kids with an itchy rash equals scratching the itchy rash, meaning possibility of a secondary bacterial infection because they can scratch and break the skin. We can use soothing lotions or sensitive skin soaps. Any of those things might help. Common medications that we use. Most have a fever. Common medications. Do not give them aspirin. No aspirin. And again, this is with viral xanthan infections. Or viral infections. Whatever you would call it. Viral infections. No aspirin. We'll use antipyretics, acetaminophen, ibuprofen. Again, make sure parents know to give the right type the right way. You do not give an infant child Tylenol and vice versa. You wouldn't have infant Tylenol or the Tylenol drops or whatever and say, okay, I need to give this to my five-year-old and they need half a teaspoon. If you give them half a teaspoon of those concentrated drops, you're going to way overdose them on the Tylenol. So make sure your parents know. Not all parents know that there's a difference with those. They need to know how to measure those. We don't use a kitchen teaspoon to measure. Most of the pharmacies will give parents syringes, so they can pull up the exact dose if whatever preparation they bought does not have that. So make sure they know how to measure it. Make sure they store it out of reach of children. And we always say that, if you've ever noticed, they have these wonderful flavors, and parents still say, here, you want some candy. You have bubble gum flavored, and you have grape flavored, and whatever, all to get the child to take it, but we need to store it out of their reach, so it's not something they can go and help themselves to. And you think, it's got child protective caps. They're pretty savvy. A lot of times they can get them open. Again, just saying. So think about that. Okay, first one. This is a picture of measles or rubiola. I don't know if I did more than the... Nope, I didn't. Okay. So, your handout, this is just a picture of it, what it looks like. They have a red maculopapular rash that gradually turns brownish in color, begins behind the ear, spreads downward. And this is all with good old plain old measles. They develop coplic spots. You see, these are coplic spots, these little white looking dots all on the buccal mucosa. So with rubiola or measles, maculopapular rash, complex spots, transmission, direct contact with droplets, primarily, sometimes with airborne precautions. The vaccination used to prevent this is the MMR. MMR stands for measles, mumps, and rubella. So they get their MMR. Isolation precautions on your handout, and it's droplet, and again above it says airborne as well, contact with airborne particles. But again, next up we have rubella. You see, rubella also says measles, but rubella is 3-day measles for that distinction. So, it presents with this pinkish maculopapular rash, which is kind of difficult to see on that picture. It kind of looks the same as the other one. Begins on the face and the neck and the scalp, spreads downward to the feet, usually over a 3-day period. As the rash develops in a new area, it fades in the previous area. They develop, and I don't have a picture. They develop pinpoint reddish spots on their soft palate with rubella, and this is called Forshimer's sign. I'm not going to ask you to define Forshimer's sign, Forshimers. I'm not going to ask you to define it. But again, the most significant, transmission, direct contact with droplets or airborne particles. Again, most importantly, transplacental transmission. So rubella, think transplacental transmission. By transplacental transmission, if the mom gets rubella while she's pregnant, then that baby will also receive rubella transplacentally, and it can have severe effects on the fetus, resulting in stillbirth, death, etc. So rubella in pregnancy is not a good thing. And that's because of transplacental transmission. So if you were supposed to give an MMR to an adolescent female, what would you need to check before you gave it?
Pregnancy.
A pregnancy test. There you go. Okay.
One is
erythema infectiosum. Children should
not be around pregnant women. There is also transplacental transmission with this disease. It is more
the clinical presentation
serious, I believe, if the pregnant woman comes in contact.
A video recorded with your boy
infected with this disease in the first and in the third trimester. But it's not something anybody wants to take any chance with because of transmissible transmission of this condition.
I don't have that. It is.
It just stopped. It's just on that slide.
Okay, I don't know. It's not showing up on my slide, so I'm very sorry about that.
Can you just start back over? We didn't get to hear anything on the last slide.
Is it showing with that one too?
On varicella, we can hear just you, but on the side with this disease, we can hear you lecturing, but also your voice in the background lecturing, like it was previously recorded.
just stop sharing? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So I just stop sharing this screen, which is fine. It's predominantly pictures, and I apologize for it doing that. I wasn't aware. I probably turned it on when I was trying to get the other ones to play. Because in this view, I do see that there are words with the slides. But anyway, so, okay, we'll just go back to talking about infectious Fitz disease. I'm sorry. So Fitz disease presents with a maculopapular lacy rash on the trunk and on the extremities. They had that fiery red, and as you probably saw on that first picture, their cheeks were fiery, fiery red. So they had that fiery red on their cheeks. And that's known as the slapped cheek sign. So they actually look like somebody smacked them across their face on both sides because they have such red little cheeks, or fiery red little cheeks. So anyway, that's with erythema infectiosum. Transmission, direct contact with droplets, airborne particles, or blood and blood products. Again, blood and blood products is another way to receive or to get erythema infectiosum. Not even worried about. So they can get it that. The other thing about erythema infectiosum, it also has transplacental transmission. So rubella and erythema infectiosum are the two that have transplacental transmission. They are in different periods of the pregnancy. I think erythema infectiosum is worse during the first and third trimester. Whereas rubella is worse in the first and second. But again, you're not going to take the risk. The same thing if somebody has measles, and hopefully we're not seeing measles cases, though we have seen some emergence of some of these that we've been vaccinated against. But if you're pregnant and you see somebody with spots, you're not going to ask, is this measles or is this rubella? So, you know, you don't want to take that risk with your baby. So, next we have varicella. You know what varicella is? Varicella is chicken pox. Clinically, varicella, they present with the macular lesions that progress to papules. Papules go to vesicles, so they form the little blisters, and go from vesicles to pustules. These lesions of chicken pox appear in crops, so they'll have a whole bunch of them. As far as a crop of lesions, can be anywhere. I know when my oldest got chicken pox, she had them from the top of her head down to the soles of her feet. When my youngest got chicken pox, I think she had two, bop, bop, on her back, and that was it for her outbreak. So, it's transmitted through direct contact, through droplets, or through airborne particles. We give them the varicella vaccine for protection. Varicella and MMR are given at 12 months of age, and they're both given sub-Q. The other immunizations are IM, but varicella and their MMR are given sub-Q.
I have a question. In the textbook, it says that varicella can be passed from mother to fetus as well. Does it have placenta transmission also?
I couldn't hear you.
happening to those trans placental trans women also. I said that in the book.
Varicella?
Yes.
I'm not aware of varicella as trans placental transmission. I've never heard that it was. I'll have to go back and look. So we give them the varicella vaccine. Isolation, airborne or contact. Common complication of varicella are the bacterial secondary skin infections from scratching. Varicella can be fatal in the immunocompromised child. So if a child that's immune compromised gets varicella, it can kill them. It can be fatal. So we need to think about that.
I just Googled that chickenpox placental transmission, and it does occur. They kind of breathe it in through the respiratory tract. And like you said, it can be fatal.
Okay. Good to know. And it is. It's good to know about that. The other thing with varicella, Reye syndrome has been known to occur after varicella infection. The reason we don't give aspirin with viral infections is because of the risk of Reye syndrome. Reye syndrome is much more likely, perhaps, after a varicella infection, but it can happen after any viral infection, but varicella is more prominent. And Reye syndrome, I think you talk about it later in this class, is a bad thing. And it can kill a child, it can put a child in PICU. It's not a good thing because of the ammonia buildup and everything else. Hand, foot, and mouth is another one.
We have a question, Ms. Snell.
Okay. Stand near the mic so maybe I can hear you. There should be a mic on your podium.
Oh, I see. Okay. What was your question?
The varicella vaccine prevents
varicella vaccination. Does that also prevent them from developing?
Will the varicella vaccine also prevent shingles?
Will the vaccine prevent shingles? No, not necessarily. What they're finding with shingles, they have a Shingrix, which is the adult shingles vaccine. It is caused by the same thing, but it's something about how the virus lives in your body and how it can come out later on as far as a shingles. So we see shingles happen more often in, I guess, in older adults after, and they've had previous varicella infection. But you would not give an adult a varicella vaccine to prevent shingles.
No.
And the likelihood of shingles, we do see it sometimes. We see it in adolescents sometimes, but it's not very likely that we see that then. It can occur, but it's not very likely.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Okay. Hand, foot, and mouth is just what it says it is. Present with a high fever. They have vesicles on their tongue and the oral mucosa, which will erode and become shallow ulcers. So they have the mouth ulcers. They have vesicles on their hands and on their feet. Hand, foot, mouth. in the wrong order. But anyway, so they have these vesicles that erode, they become ulcers. It's not very fun to have. Transmission, direct contact with fecal, oral secretions, fecal, bacteria, fecal, feces, let's say feces, oral secretions. This is something spread mostly through saliva. So they have the oral secretions, they go to the bathroom, they don't wash their hands very well, their hands wind up in their mouth. Happens. happens, because I don't know if I've said it before, kids are grubby. Peds patients are grubby. They don't think about it. They don't have the, you know, they see something on the ground and they think it's good to pick it up and put it in their mouth. I always think about Elf. You know, he's in New York and there's gum underneath the railing and he's, ooh, and he puts it in his mouth. Okay, that's like a child. Child sees it on the ground, picks it up, and they will put it in their mouth. So they're grubby. No other word for it. Gotta love them, but they're still grubby. Mumps, classical clinical presentation of mumps. We have that parotid gland swelling. So they swell up like little bullfrogs. Right under here, the parotid glands can be prevented, of course, with the MMR, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. Complication of mumps, aseptic meningitis, orchitis. So if you had an adolescent male that got mumps in his adolescence, they were very worried because orchitis, it goes to the testes, and they were very concerned about sterility. Sterility as a result is very rare, can happen in some occasions or some occurrences, but it is very rare. So it is something we have to think about. It's droplet transmission, and we use the MMR vaccine to prevent or as used in that. My only mumps story that I have is my brother, who's 2 years older than I. He got mumps the last week of school. So he was out for finals and everything else for school. And he swole up like a bullfrog. And I remember seeing pictures, he's smiling and everything. It's like, kid sis here got him the first day of summer vacation. Did not swell. Did not talk to, no, I still talk to my brother. But I mean, it was like, that's just no fair, you know. But anyway, so that's my only mumps story. Fortunately now we have the MMR and we give the MMR and hopefully our children are protected. And you do put them on droplet precaution until 9 days after the initial onset of swelling. Because again, we're looking at parotid glands, saliva, everything else, so we can still have transmission or droplet transmission. So the next are zoonotic, I like saying, zoonotic infections and vector-borne infections. And these are diseases caused by infectious agents transmitted directly or indirectly from animals or vectors, mosquitoes, ticks, other insect vectors. So we don't think about them sometimes. First one is cat scratch fever. That is an actual thing. It doesn't sound like it's an actual thing. It sounds like it's kind of made up. I had cat scratch fever. But it is an actual thing. Cats carry bacteria in their saliva. Treatment is supportive and aimed at managing their symptoms. So they have typically with cat scratch, headache, fever, anorexia, fatigue. Oh, thank you. One pack a piece? Is that what we decided? Two packs a piece. For A and B turn. You're awesome. That's Miss Hill, sorry, with our PPE, our masks. So that is actually something. Rabies. Oh, the other thing with cat scratch, they can have a papule or a pustule at the side of the bite. Something can develop. They can have like swollen lymph nodes. And all that where the cat bit them or scratched them. So, we know we get rabies from contaminated animal bites. The thing about rabies is this disease, once it establishes itself, once a person truly has it, not just exposed, they have rabies, or they got rabies or contracted rabies, however you want to say it, it is typically fatal once the virus has established itself. So there have been, last I saw, two cases of people that contracted rabies and survived. Only two. So it's not something we play around with. If determination is made to treat, then the vaccines are as follows, and these are listed, and again, your handout. The immune rabies globulin, or the HRIG, half the dose is infiltrated locally around the wound, and the rest is given IM. So they get HRIG. The human diploid cell vaccine, the HDCV, is best if it's administered within 48 hours after the bite. Then they receive it again on days 3, 7, 14, and 28. Giving somebody the rabies vaccine, the HDCV, it's a very detailed process. We had a young boy in the clinic that was bitten by a dog, and he was in, well, actually more than one dog, and he had pretty severe bites, and he came in to get his rabies, his first or second in his series of rabies shots. You have this lengthy instruction sheet, how it's diluted, how it's mixed, how this is done, how that is done, and everything in regards to that vaccine. And then it's administered IM, special needle, special everything. So it's kind of a big deal. Lyme disease and Rocky Mountain spotted fever are both transmitted by ticks. So Lyme disease is a deer tick bite. And Lyme disease, you have that typical bullseye type rash. So it's red in the center, cleared around, and then you have another rash around it. So it kind of looks like a bullseye when we're talking about Lyme disease. For Lyme disease, they give antibiotics. They give kids older than age 8 doxycycline. So can you think of why we have to wait till they're at least 8 to give them doxy? What does doxycycline do to the teeth?
Causes discoloration.
Very definitely. So we have to think about that permanent discoloration of the teeth. So we don't want to give them doxy if they're younger than 8. We'll give amoxicillin to those kiddos younger than age 8, and we'll have them on it for 14 to 28 days. So that's with Lyme disease. Rocky Mountain spotted fever, also caused by a tick, a wood tick or a dog tick. Delay in diagnosis and therapy are factors that influence the severity of the disease. The treatment for Rocky Mountain spotted fever is, again, doxycycline, regardless of their age. So we don't worry about their age if they have Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Fortunately, we do not see cases of Rocky Mountain spotted fever in this vicinity. Not to say it couldn't occur, but we don't typically see those instances of that. We can also have parasitic and helminthic infections. So, of course, the parasites we talk about, mainly a big one that we see, head lice and scabies. Those are our parasitic, or the parasites that we see frequently in kids. With head lice or pediculosis capitis, that is transmitted by direct contact with an infected person or contact with an infected object. So we do see that occurring with that transmission or with that. clinically, you see the little knits. I used to have a picture of the knits, the little knits, and that you typically see them better like at the base of their nape of the neck, I'm sorry, at the nape of the neck or behind the ears or whatever. So you'll see them there. And the reason it's so predominant in kids a lot of times is because they don't do anything sitting in one place. Now, of course, with COVID precautions and the screens and everything, but watch little ones when they color. They don't just sit still and color. They put their whole body into it, and usually they lean over the desk and they're coloring that way. So it becomes a kind of big thing. Scabies and worms, there's not really much to say. With scabies, they have lesions, and you'll see the lesions. A lot of times, because of scabies burrows, you'll see these little fine grayish lines, kind of like a pencil line, and that's the little burrow from the scabies, or from scabies. So you can kind of read the instructions for that, because I see it's at 9:50, and we're supposed to be out of here at 9:50. So that last little bit you can get on your own. It's not deep thought information. So I will stop the recording and again, if you have your paperwork, I didn't see much paperwork get turned in.